Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Science Bloggers podcast. I'm David Latchman, and my guest this week is someone you already know, Wilf Nelson. The last time Wilf was on, we talked about neuroscience, and Wilf debunked some widely believed brain myths. In this episode, we talk about science communication and Wilf's podcast, What a Cooler Neuroscience. Wilf tells us why a podcast is the ideal medium for him to communicate the complexities of neuroscience. So, hello, Wilf, again. How are you doing?
I am okay, and this is again.
Yeah, it is again. So, this time we are talking about something new outside of what you do. We are talking about your podcast, What a Cooler Neuroscience.
Yes.
So, why don't you tell us a little something about that?
Yeah. So, this is something I do outside my research. There is the neuroscience-y researching me, and then when I clock off, I do this as a side thing. And as anybody who has listened to the episode that I talk about my research in, even the simple version I tried to give can get out of hand pretty fast. There is no short version of neuroscience quite a bit of the time. It is just inevitably a very complicated subject. And because of that, it can be quite hard to explain it simply. So I have done science communication for a while. I first did it back when I was 2013. And there was an entrepreneurial society for students at my university. What they would do was they'd do talks. And I was asked to come in as a psychologist and talk about the psychology of business or the psychology of selling or the psychology of marketing and the psychology of markets, which I did. But it was still dumbed down and I got better. And I was still an undergrad at that point explaining effectively the things I'd learned in a lecture 2 days before, which is fine. But I got onto my master's, and then there was a regular post for me to do talks at what's called applicant visit days and open days, where you're simply presenting parts of your research or what you do. And I quickly explained to the people who were there that it wasn't going to work, because to really understand how inhibition and regulation happen across the cortex, how different parts of your brain are actually turning each other on and off, and to provide slides with that that make any kind of sense, I kind of needed actually to have them for an hour beforehand to explain quite a few fundamentals about electrophysiology and neural signaling, which is not a fun talk. I had to do part of my master's. It's not fun. But I was told I couldn't do that. So what I did was, instead, I did talks on the generally interesting topics of psychology that I wanted to do. So I did a talk on how we make our choose our actions and how we do free will, based on Benjamin Libet's work, which is quite controversial, moving up to the more recent stuff like Patrick Haggard's work at UCL, which is far less controversial, but still basically along the same lines, and a really nice body of work that explains arguably that human beings don't have free will, but don't think about that too much. I also did talks on how putting people into machines is a fundamentally flawed concept and doesn't make the slightest lick of sense. I did talks on how people will become inevitably bored with things, about how you'll lose interest from a neuroscience perspective or from a biochemical perspective. And these talks were really well received. I ended up doing this for a couple of years and actually brought in a regular paycheck. That was the first time I was, you know, really paid to talk, which was nice. And as that happened, I got this problem of being asked to continually reduce my talks. You know, they gave me 45 minutes. Could you do it in 40? Could you do it in 35? Could you do it in 30? And this is no blame on the organisers, but they had multiple things they needed to fit in, and they couldn't always have everybody sit in a lecture hall when you got people there only for 3-4 hours to see the whole university listening for an hour to me talk about, you know, random neuro effects that probably wouldn't ever matter again. Interesting, but also taking up a lot of time on a tight schedule. However, there was no simple version. I was doing the real version of these talks, and the first 20, 25 minutes, even half an hour, was laying the foundation for people to even understand what they were about to hear. Because there's a lot to neuroscience, and if you don't have the education in it, it can get really baffling real fast. So I was giving that background to them, but it was taking up a lot of time. And eventually, the talk just got really short. I couldn't do any of the talks that I wanted. And then I was asked if I wouldn't do talks anymore. What they wanted me to do was sit at a table in a hall and have on the screen some of the stimuli we use, and people could just pass by and nod and go ask a couple of questions if they wanted. But that just had no interest for me. So I started a podcast. I'd been a fan of podcasts for quite some time and had always thought, well, I could at least start. But I didn't want to just do the Wilf Neuroscience Hour, where I randomly talk about whatever topic was interesting to me. I wanted to do something a lot more structured. I wanted to do something also more ambitious. What I did with that was think, okay, well, the main thing I couldn't do was explain neuroscience, like real deep level neuroscience, because I need time. But on a podcast, I have time. I can get people listen to hour, 2 hour podcasts. And I thought, even then, I don't need that. I just need people for 40 minutes, 45 minutes. So I made Water Cooler Neuroscience. And the idea of Water Cooler Neuroscience was, what if we had a chat that was casual and you could share interesting stories like around a water cooler, but we had it about something as complicated as neuroscience? So the first series I did was with the help of the public engagement team at the University of Birmingham and the Centre for Human Brain Health. They were both very helpful in getting me set up with access to people who would fit the kind of show I would eventually make, and started making the show. And we started off first. So if you listen to the show, you'll hear a myth. We share these fun stories. We share things about how every neuroscientist I've ever met, every psychologist I've ever met, has something that the public just don't understand about how the brain works. You don't use 10% of your brain. You don't really have these clear segmented lines on evolutionary history about what part belongs to what animal, and therefore we've got that from an evolutionary ancestor. The brain's very fluid. It changes. You don't have, on occasion, clear links that your visual system only processes visual information and sends it up the chain. Sometimes what you're expecting to see can cause pseudo-hallucinations that you see what you expect, but they're so normal you don't even realize they exist. All of these fascinating truths about how the brain works, we put that into the episode. And then I wanted to just discuss that the people that I was around and working with had really cool life stories, really interesting people who trekked across the world. They'd got to work with some of the most interesting minds of their generation. They'd done really fundamental findings. One of them, Jackie Chappell, effectively proved, although it's a very contentious proved, but proved that crows can not just use tools that we give them, but make tools. It was an enormous finding, and I got to interview her. And the concept was, don't dumb it down. Just explain more. You have the time. Explain even more. And if you come across something that you can't explain, we'll pause the recording, we'll have a chat about it, and then we'll go for all of it. So by the end, I'm not saying that you'll be a neuroscientist, but you'll understand a lot more than if you just watch the News at 5 highlight reel.
Yeah, because, you know, I've listened to a few of your episodes, and...
Oh, thank you.
And yeah, neuroscience is not my background, it's physics. So a lot of this information is just like, wow, this is... Sometimes I even have to, like, go back and, like, what did he just say there? So it's a learning experience, and even then I'm probably, like, forgotten, like, 90% of it by now.
But... Yeah, but I'm not going to test you on it by the end. What I want to do is provide an episode where all of that information is there for you, and you can use it however you want. So if you do read the first few, so if you do listen to the first few episodes, and they blow your mind, feel no issue that if you want to, like, re-listen to a section, or we had some stuff about how children and animals think, and we have a group of listeners who listen to it before it goes out to test, and some of them were just like, I just need to ask some questions, because it wasn't they didn't understand it, they just couldn't process that children think in such different ways to how we think they do.
Yeah.
And things you only really understand when you put it in a lab.
Right. But, you know, I think with any time that you learn something, and I guess you may know this from your psychology background, that you can't just listen or read or watch something once when you're learning something. There needs to be a certain amount of repetition. So
yeah,
I guess that's why I'm probably going to listen to one of your podcasts and forget like 95% of it, because it's all so new to me.
Yeah, no, and that's great. And if a listener wants to come along and just, you know, listen to them once a day on their commute to work and don't worry about it, then, you know, they have a couple of cool stories. That's sweet. That's what I do with podcasts half the time I listen to them. If on the other side, you really want to do what you want to do, which is go back and, you know, think, okay, I really need to break this down. There's so much here. You can do that too. And I'm always available on Twitter if there are questions. We had somebody who got really into one of our episodes on a series we do called A Brain Talking About Brains. I ended up having a whole afternoon conversation with this person about the concept. The episode ended on a concept that your brain is only there for moving. And if you don't need to move, why do you need a brain? It's a concept that comes obviously from motion psychology and the field of motor neuroscience, but it was a really interesting concept. And there are animals, and they're seafaring animals, that when they stop moving as part of their natural life cycle and settle down in one place permanently and fuse to the rock, they actually eat their own brain because they don't need it anymore. And that concept was so cool to that person that we had this whole conversation about what that would even mean for just understanding brains in general and what they actually do.
Yeah, I think I have to listen to that episode.
I think it's cognitive dissonance in the Brain Talking About Brain Season 1, but don't quote me on that.
But I'll look for it, I'll check it out, because, again, that concept just blew my mind.
Yeah, it blows a lot of people's minds when they first hear it. I also have heard some very strong reactions to it from neuroscientists, along the lines of, are you actually serious? Neuroscientists can have strong opinions about things.
So, when you created this podcast, who did you think your audience was going to be, and is it different to now after you've done it for how long have you been doing this?
I think probably when I first properly thought up the idea, I didn't even care if I had an audience. I didn't think who it would be. I didn't want to assume that one person would be into neuroscience and one person wouldn't. I just thought I'd make the series. Then sense caught up with me and I actually did think about it. We know that a lot of our listeners are in that 16 to 35. That's actually two groups of people. That's the people who are, you know, really coming to terms with science as science is in their formative years. They're teenagers, they're young adults, and they're actually getting away from that super restrictive high school version of science, which won't talk about why it's that way, but high school science has its uses. But once you're free from it, you realize the richness of science. You realize how much there is, how uncertain science can be, and why that uncertainty is a really good thing. So we know that some of our listeners are in that group, and some of them are people who are older, they've graduated, they have their jobs, and they just want to hear more about science. They don't want to, you know, obviously work in the lab and quit their jobs and retrain, but they want to be more informed. They like hearing about stuff. Like, we had a guest, Sarah Beck, one of the first guests I interviewed, and she was really nice and made the process so easy. So over 70% of children had imaginary friends as their kids. Only about 30% of adults, and Sarah's episode will have the exact numbers on this, remember having one. That means that there's about 40 to half of the population who don't remember having an imaginary friend. And what got me is, I can't remember if I had one. But odds on chances, I did. And I forgot.
Wow.
So, and that's just really cool. And I'm not making this podcast because I want to go, okay, now I've told you that, I'm going to sign you up for a neuroscience degree and a master's and a PhD. Just somebody wants to go, you know what, that was kind of cool. And I'm happy that I was able to learn a few bit more psychology, but I've got my own life, I've got my own job, I've got my own family, and that's what I do for most of the time. And I'm just presenting, you know, a few cool tidbits across the day. Something that's interesting to listen to without it being like this massive thing. Because on occasion, neuroscience can be this massive thing.
Yeah. As to the imaginary friend, I remember, like, when I was a kid, yeah, I had one as well. And I don't know if you've seen this Pixar movie. The movie is, like, the name is, like, completely, you know, it's where this girl, Riley, and she has, like, these
Inside Out.
Four or five avatars in her head.
Yeah, Inside Out. I saw that on my honeymoon.
Right. And
it was long story, but yeah, I got to see it on my honeymoon, which was kind of hilarious.
I know there's one scene where she has her imaginary friend, and that imaginary friend gets forgotten. And I don't know, is any of the neuroscience that I guess you can say in that movie depicted, is there any truth to it? Did I get it right?
Memories are actually a bit complicated. So from a really scientific standpoint, nothing is ever forgotten. And that's not in a fanciful, nobody ever leaves your lives. People can be tested on something and say, do you remember this information? And they'll go, no. We can then test them 5-10 years later, and we provide something that helps remind them. Smells are amazing for this. You could hear songs, you can see a photo and suddenly remember things. And we just realized that the reason we couldn't get it out of you the first time was we didn't have the right trigger. We didn't have the right thing to pull that memory out of your conscious, well, subconscious. So we don't really ever know if a memory is lost or if a memory is effectively just inaccessible somewhere in your brain.
Right.
But we do know that memories can be overwritten. The same memory can be updated. We also know that there is a likely chance that memories can just be lost forever. Forgetting is a very useful thing that we do. There is so much useless information that you can have. I spent some of my lunch break today watching a couple of game reviews. I don't need to actually hold that information. I watched it for fun. But if I had all of that information as clear in my head as I have statistical information that I use for my job, that's obviously going to conflict. It's going to get in the way. So forgetting is a really useful mechanic. Imaginary friends appear to be very highly forgotten, but there haven't been systematic tests on every part of how a child, what children do, that's quite unique. So not many adults have imaginary friends. Quite a few children do. There haven't been systematic tests looking at every aspect of what makes a child's cognition different to ours than how they remember forgetting. But it was just really interesting that Sarah knew this and was able to bring it across on the podcast. But she also explained in great depth on that episode, understanding how children and animals and effectively everything outside of a healthy adult human mind can help us to better understand a healthy adult human mind.
That kind of makes sense.
Sometimes the fact it doesn't make sense makes it a good idea.
Yeah, because I've heard someone say, like, if you need to study what's normal in the human brain, you also have to study what's abnormal. So you can have a baseline of what normal is.
Yeah. Really simple way to do it is, say you want to understand the visual system, go get 100,000, a million people if you can, who all say that they see normally, test them, they have no complaints, then go find as many people as you can with visual impairments, different ways of seeing problems. Some people can see fine, but they can't see objects, or they can't see objects on other objects. It's called ataxia. It's a problem with the visual system's ability to identify where things are in the room. And you'll start to realize that maybe some of those people who have quote-unquote injuries or quote-unquote abnormal brains actually start to look very similar to some of the people you had in your quote-unquote normal group, or what we call neurotypical, that's the proper term for it. And you start to build up this really good information from looking at damage and health and differences, just how the brain works. But you can go even further and start looking at different populations who are all healthy, and you start to realize that how a child sees and understands the world, because their brain is not as developed, they have certain parts of their brain that are growing in different ways that they use more as you get older, they do different things, they process the world in different ways. And that can be really interesting for trying to give a frame of reference for understanding our own minds.
I don't know if this is something that you're aware of, because from what I've been told, when people donate their brains, it's usually because something happened to them and they want to help science out. So I have Alzheimer's. I want researchers to understand this disease better. So I'll donate my brain. And that's because people are amazing. You know, they want to help out if they can. And the biggest problem is we don't have enough normal brains, if that makes sense. So we don't always have a baseline as to what a physically normal brain is. Is that true, or is that...
I'm not a medical doctor, so I can't answer from like a medical perspective, but I do know if you were to accept MRI scans, which let us see the structure of the brain, we can see how your neurons are spread across your brain. We have thousands of those scans, thousands and thousands of fMRI scans that show the structure, the functions, the layout, how that changes over your lifetime of brains. Of course, people donating parts of themselves once they're dead for science is a great thing. It's enormously altruistic and helps to really progress the science. But if I could say anything, if you have the time and you're really interested, just sign up for research studies. If you live near a university, there will be a call for people to do studies. And if you have something that is an injury or an abnormality, and that's not at all wrong, there are so many abnormalities that are just normal in the weird sense that we expect to see them in the world. Some people see the world in different ways. Some people hear in different ways. Some people handle how they move in different ways. That those differences, while called abnormal in a scientific sense, are entirely expected. If you want to help science, See if there are scientists around who want to study. Nobody is going to be upset that you offer your time and help.
Yeah, and that's good advice. You know, if you can put some time in it, volunteer, and, you know, you contribute to hopefully making things better for somewhere, someone.
Yeah, but of course, as a caveat, if you've got a condition and you just don't feel up to it, don't worry. You getting better is a lot more important than some scientist getting the data.
Right, of course.
We are, as a psychologist and a neuroscientist, you're trained with ethics so much, we're not sitting around going, why does this person with condition X not turn up at my door and say they can test on me? We expect that if you have something and it's for your sake, you'll go get help and be treated, and then your brain wouldn't have those abnormalities or you wouldn't show those conditions. Nobody is upset at that.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, do what's right for you.
Yeah, but never feel afraid to approach a university and be like, can I do some testing? Not like testing on people, but can I be part of a test? Can I help out? There will be somebody who's probably willing to take your time and do some tests. We're always interested.
So it seems podcasting, you've really found your niche in terms of science communication. So is there any philosophical reason why you think podcasting works as opposed to, say, being a YouTuber or writing articles?
I chose to be a podcaster for a very particular reason, which I'll relate it to articles and YouTubers, but as the scientist in me immediately wants to say, I don't have data and I can't prove it. With a podcast, podcasts can be on average somewhere between half an hour to an hour long if you look at the data. That gives me plenty of time to explain the complexities of neuroscience. And there is no simple version of neuroscience. The more you want me to simplify it, the more I have to take away all of the stuff that's actually interesting about it. And when I'm interviewing guests, to go through all of their work, which is really rich and interesting, the more that I am asking them to dumb it down, the more I'm asking them to get rid of complicated bits, the more I'm not giving that to the listeners. And that's what I said. We don't tell them to remove stuff. We just say, explain more, take more time. In an article, that gets hard because that means effectively I'm writing a book each time. And it's just so much more efficient to do an hour-long interview rather than write a very long, heavy piece of prose that probably won't fit into people's days very easily. So I am on quite a few of the neuroscience and psychology websites, and they're great. They give you these really quick, short pieces of information, but the real mechanics that we provide on the podcast about how did you do that study, how did you really break down, tell me what a day in your lab is like on this experiment, they don't do on those sites because that's not what they want to do. So that's why I didn't write articles. As for YouTube, effectively it came down to I just don't have the same skills that I want to really make the videos and present them in a way where I would show everything that I want to show. On a podcast, I can rely on the listener's imagination really nicely to fill in the gaps and understand these complex images of me trying to break down how the brain works and all of the different systems. A person's imagination fills it in. With YouTube, again, the videos on general are much shorter and it doesn't fit what we were trying to do with this project. When we made Water Cooler Neuroscience, we were really trying to get in depth, and if somebody wanted to come along, they could get all the information they wanted about this, just shy of having to actually be a neuroscience master student themselves. We may move to YouTube later on. It's definitely something I've considered, but it would have to be in a way that I'm really comfortable with the visual element of it, and probably looking at having a whole animation team to make the videos that we want, which we can just do with the podcast in a really natural, clean way right now.
Yeah, you know, I think that totally makes sense. Because, again, as a science communicator, you think about these various ways in which you can communicate science and to whom you communicate in science when you use that medium. And I think you're right, especially when you look at the video aspect of it. And I know this because I've done script writing and storyboarding for some websites. And you do think about, okay, how those visual elements play into what you're going to say and how you're going to say it, right? That visual and audio experience in addition to what you're saying. So it's sort of like an added layer. And unless you have that training, it's a lot to deal with. And yeah, podcasting in a way, it's efficient. But I can say, you know, article writing is also efficient in its own way. You just have to know exactly what your goals are and what you're trying to do.
Yeah, no, and there are some really good neuroscience videos out there. Quite a bit of the stuff I learned in my master's was explained. through watching neuroscience videos, but it didn't fit what I wanted to do. I wanted quite a bit of the time to have really interesting conversations. I say that the best part of running the podcast and the business it's attached to is I get to have the most interesting conversations I have in the whole year from doing the podcast. They are the conversations that I bring up repeatedly going, this was so damn cool to hear about. For the videos, I don't think it would have worked in the same way. And like I said, I might in the future work on those. If you're hearing this episode a few years later and you found it on an archive, definitely go and have a look now if I've made videos or have a look what else I did. I will have done something. But it fit what I wanted to do. And I'm quite happy that I'll do my thing. Others can do other stuff. As long as the audience you listening get more science, I'm just going to try and provide you in a way that makes me comfortable because then I can give you the best quality. Because again, it's that scientific training. It's hammered into you every second you're in a lab. Quality matters before anything else. And that mindset just pervaded into me doing science communication.
Right. So as to future episodes, what are some of your plans? What are you going to be talking about in the future?
So as of April 2020, for those who are listening, we are firstly creating a series which is going to be on the biochemistry of the brain. So I am not a biochemist by training. I know a bit about the chemistry of the brain, but it is not something I would get a PhD in. My PhD is in the cognitive parts of your brain rather than its chemistry. So we're doing a series on that, which is stepping out of my comfort zone quite a bit. And we're going to be looking at quite a few of the interesting topics. But again, I don't want to just be told, oh yeah, this drug did this and it made people think better. Like, it's not, no. Explain to me how it works. Explain to me how you understand that it works. What does your lab do? In that same way that we've picked apart and understood lots of other people's work in neuroscience that I do understand. We have two episodes in our original series where we explain, and I got a physicist, we explain how an fMRI and an EEG works from a mechanics point of view. Not you lie in it and this is your day in a hospital. Mechanically, how a physicist understands them. And then we got somebody who didn't even, well, okay, for American and Canadian audiences, that we got somebody who hadn't finished upper high school and they understood it. So that was really the goal. Now we're bringing that to biochemistry. On top of that, I am working on another part of the series, which is called Brain Talking About Brains, which we've done a couple of episodes for, but I'm thinking of doing a lot more of a long form series where I start to really break down all of the things that when you get training, make a psychologist a psychologist. Everything that I had to learn in order to be counted as an accredited psychologist, start putting that into a podcast, start really showing the training that you have and how that shapes your thought processes. So I've been writing those episodes now and looking at learning psychology, and you start to see how psychology for nearly 50 to 60 years view people in a very mechanical, we are organics robot kind of way, but it informs a lot of theory and it really works. It only works to a certain degree. You don't get all of human life through, but you can start to understand really fundamental pieces about why people do one thing versus another, why people behave in certain ways in repeatable patterns from looking at these works on behavioral psychology. So translating that into an archive for people to be able to have and break down the walls from those who have a formal psychology education and those who don't is something I'm interested in looking into, and we're going to start, you know, putting forward, making the episodes and trying to get some Kickstarter campaigns so we can really boost those qualities and hopefully even make them into videos, which is why I keep toying with this idea of videos in my head.
Again, you know, I think we've covered like a lot of subjects, a lot of area, just like we did in the last episode. So I guess as we wrap up, is there anything you'd like to tell the listeners that I didn't quite give you a chance to?
I think the thing I would mostly say is I would really have a look for the series that we're looking to make. We are looking to branch into the most inaccessible parts of neuroscience and psychology, using the same system from the earlier series that we know makes it more accessible. The things that normally you wouldn't even try to go close to, we are trying to make them not, again, you'd be able to call yourself a neurochemist and, you know, write equations on your walls, but at least know what they are. At least understand what somebody in those labs is doing and what their aims and their goals are, rather than just say they're using chemicals to make us smarter, because I think that misses a lot of the richness. And as with a brain talking about brains, we're looking to try and break down some of the differences and I became very aware making this series of the privilege I have of being a psychologist, of all of that information and training I have that tells me about how people think and how the mind works. I simply want to be able to provide that for other people in a way that they can do at their own leisure and that doesn't require the kind of heavy instrumental learning in a formal institution that just doesn't suit some people. For some people, they're going to be very happy to go get their own psychology degrees. We can have a chat. I love talking to other psychologists. It's not something I get to do very often anymore. I talk to a lot more neuroscientists and a lot more people who are engineers and physicists. So if you are a psychologist, want to have a chat, please come along. But to those who just want to learn a bit more psychology, be a bit more learned, but not upturn your entire life, we're hoping to provide a subject and an archive that can really help you to understand more about why when I look at a scene versus you look at a scene, the chances are the psychologist in me will see something different. I think that's what I'd say.
Okay, so why don't you tell people how they can find your podcast? What URLs, Twitter, Facebook?
Yeah, so we are on iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher. I apologize that we are not on Google Podcasts because I am British and apparently that's not allowed. Past that, I went over 40 different sites and we are on as many different podcasting apps as I can possibly put us on to accommodate whatever niche podcasting app that you love and everybody else doesn't appreciate enough. I am there for you. We're also got the episodes on our website called Water Cooler. Water Cooler is in the water cooler that you have probably in your office. Neuroscience.co.uk, all one word. And all of our episodes are on there. We are also going to be making specific special episodes for people who support the website and the podcast, which will have content on episodes that you can't get anywhere else. So have a look out for that. We're just excited to try and talk about science. It's literally all I spend my day thinking about.
All right. I'll be sure to put those links in the show notes. And it was really nice having you back on the show again.
Oh, yes. One small note. If you would like, we post pretty much every day on Facebook, Reddit, Instagram, and Twitter. You can have a look at what we're looking at. We even do, on occasion, a fun water cooler eats, where we post some tasty food and stuff that us on the team have been eating. So have a look. If you don't just also want episodes, but you want something to quickly scroll by, we try and accommodate for that as well.
All right. Sounds fun. I'll definitely check it out, and I'll encourage anyone listening to do so as well.
I hope that whoever listens to this enjoys them. Please hit me up on Twitter if you have questions.
All right. And again, thank you for being here.
Yes, you're welcome.
I hope you enjoy my talk with Wolf and learn from it. And please be sure to like, share, subscribe, or leave a comment wherever you listen to this episode. Anything you can do will really help this channel. I also look to you joining us for our next episode when I talk to a new science communicator.